Okay, welcome to our next talk by John Leonard, Apache CouchDB Sync Deep Drive. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, more people coming in. Oh, so close.
They'll keep dropping.
No, we'll wait for them. It's a bunch of them. Thanks all for coming. Take your time. No rush. We've got plenty of time.
We don't.
All right, welcome. Welcome to my talk about Apache CouchDB, the synchronization deep dive talk. Who here has seen my introduction to CouchDB talk yesterday? One, two people. All right, so first few minutes going to be a very tiny recap of that talk, just very high-level bits. You can fall asleep for the first 5 minutes. I'll tell you when to wake up again. For everyone else, I'm Jan Lehnert. I've been with CouchDB since 2006, with Apache CouchDB since 2008, because I've been with the incubation and graduation of CouchDB. And since 2011, I've been the PMC chair and vice president of Apache CouchDB at the Apache Software Foundation, which is a really long title that only means I get to write more emails than everybody else. I can't buy anything from this. I'm the longest active contributor for CouchDB, and I'm also the CEO and co-founder of Neighborhoody Software that does services and support around CouchDB and a bunch of other things. Like I said, really short. Oh, no, maybe before I get there. I've done everything in CouchDB from evangelizing like this, community work, core engineering. I'm still doing all of these things as well. To get started, here's the high-level marketing pitch for CouchDB. Seamless multi-master sync that scales from big data to mobile with an intuitive HTTP JSON API and designed for reliability. Again, I gave a talk about explaining all of these buzzwords yesterday. I hope you can see find the slides and the recording, the audio at least, online very soon, I hope. This talk is about the multi-master sync and how it actually works. Before we get there, again, really short recap, what CouchDB, how it actually, what the small bits are, how it works, what I call the basics. The main protocol to talk to CouchDB is HTTP. I say the main protocol, the only protocol. You'd speak HTTP to CouchDB. At this point, this is no longer controversial. At a time when we started, people thought HTTP for a database. What are you thinking? Today, this is normal. I think it's a very good progression there. HTTP has a lot of advantages over other protocols. There's a lot of, it's very well understood. It's supported by all the programming environments. There's dedicated hardware and software to do all sorts of fun things like load balancing, failover, monitoring. If you tell your operations team, I have a new service that speaks HTTP, can you integrate that into our architecture? They will say yes, because they already have other stuff that speaks HTTP, so they're very happy about this. The storage format of CouchDB is JSON. JSON is the lingua franca of data exchange these days. It's kind of finally fulfilling what XML tried to promise by doing things entirely differently, where XML tried to be able to model all the data structures that all the programming languages have. JSON is only the subset of all the primitive data types that programming languages have. So I can take a Java object and serialize it into JSON and deserialize it back into Python and make use of this without having to do a lot of translation work. This also cuts out the ORM middle layer, which is kind of nice. We call the JSON data records documents. Documents are identified by unique identifier, it's the ID, and so-called content addressable revisions, the different versions of a data record. I'll explain what this all means. This is basically what the talk is about. Databases need to be able to query. We have a fairly unique incremental and persistent MapReduce system for querying that I'm happy to explain to you, which is also part of the previous talk. But this is not the scope for this. Just know that there's very cool stuff that you can do with this. The next interesting high-level thing is what we call a changes feed. There's an index that's built into every database that allows us to answer the question, what happened since the beginning of time of the database, and any step in between. Think of it as Git log, but for your database, and available as a real-time stream over HTTP, so connecting CouchDB to other data sources, store it in CouchDB first, and then stream it for further processing. It's very, very easy to build. So that's kind of nice. CouchDB comes in a single node in a clustered version. And one of the big design decisions we have made with CouchDB is that regardless of which one you use, it's the same API. In fact, there is actually no single node version of CouchDB. A single node instance of CouchDB is just a cluster with one node. This allows you to build applications against CouchDB and have CouchDB grow behind the scenes as your application grows, but you don't have to rewrite your application to accommodate a new clustered database. Most other databases that allow single node and multi-node, they want to appeal to developers a little bit more, so they put in a lot of features into the single node version. And then when you move to a multi-node version, which they also support, some of these features stop working correctly or as fast. The downside is in CouchDB, you don't get a lot of fun features that other databases have. So it's a little bit more work to get going with CouchDB, but then you're guaranteed to be able to scale basically infinitely, which is kind of nice. Speaking of design decisions, real quick, data safety is the number one concern of CouchDB. If you tell CouchDB, here, hold this data for me, and CouchDB says, yo, I got this, CouchDB has this data. In the single node case, the worst thing that can happen is that your hard drive corrupts. In that case, CouchDB can't do very much. In the cluster version, you can define how many backups you want, and then you have to have as many backups as you have. All of these hard drives have to go bad, so the likelihood of you losing data is very small. It's built for fault tolerance. We use highly concurrent and fault tolerant programming languages and runtime Erlang. I'm happy to talk to you about at length about how great Erlang is if you want after the talk. It's very good for isolating issues for individual requests, but handling thousands of requests concurrently. If one of them fails, none of the others even know that there's something going on. So it's very, very good for writing robust software. CouchDB is built with crash-only design. Data is always consistent on disk. So when CouchDB crashes, the kernel crashes, you run out of memory, the power cord gets pulled, and you start up CouchDB again, there is no fix-up phase. It can just continue working and all your data is still in place. If you've ever waited a weekend for my ISM check to finish, you know what I'm talking about. There's a few long-running operations inside CouchDB. All of them are resumable. They have checkpoints. So you don't lose any of the processing that has happened. And everything is idempotent, so if you run a request a couple of times, the end result is the same. So that's the high-level overview. This is a single instance of CouchDB. It could also be a cluster. I'm just explaining what the graph could be. So this could be a cluster of 3 CouchDB nodes, or 5, or 10, or just a single node. I'm going through a bunch of topologies to give you an idea what you can do with CouchDB. This is what we call a hot spare. These could be in different availability zones of your cloud provider to make sure you always have a copy in a data center that your cloud provider says is always available, even if the other one has an issue. Most other databases support this as well. If you want to scale out read requests, it doesn't happen these days as much anymore, but if you do, you can do this with Couch as well. Most other databases as well. Here's where it gets interesting. That's the multi-master or the multi-primary version of this. You have 2 databases. You can write to them at the same time. They synchronize data behind the scenes and come up eventually with a consistent set of data. Some databases support this. CouchDB can go even further. You can have 3 or even any number more of active databases, and they all synchronize data behind the scenes, and it all ends up working. Most other databases throw their hands up at this and stop working. This could be cloud provider regions, so you have data close to the US East Coast, West Coast, and the EU West Coast. This is also good for fault tolerance. If you're in a smaller setup and maybe have office software that runs locally within your office, you have a Sevilla office, a New York office, and a Tokyo office, the databases can all synchronize all the data everywhere, but people in Tokyo will never have to wait for any data that was captured in Sevilla or in New York, so the user interaction never has to do this round trip around halfway around the world. So user interaction is really fast. This could be that. So, one more. This is one that we're currently building. In Germany, every city is responsible for maintaining public infrastructure, like roads and bridges. They all have management software for this, so that they can, this road is broken, here's an engineering office that can, or a company that can fix it, manage the contract and the specification and everything. But of course, no city trusts any other city with that data, so they all have a copy of the same software and their own database with this. But then on the county level, they need to coordinate for streets that are across city borders, boundaries. They have to do special accounting and more statistics, so you have another level of this that all the cities feed into. And then on the state level, the same happens again, budgeting. usually happens on the state level in Germany. So that all needs to be collected there. And on the country level, we need to know what's going on all over the place to see like how many streets are we fixing every year and so on, so policy can be made. So this is something that you can build with the CouchDB. You can even do things like in the country or state, have arrows going back down and have information flowing back to the individual cities if you wanted to. Same structure could be a corporate structure. This is a supermarket chain in Italy. All the tills run CouchDB. There's a central CouchDB in the office that has an uplink to the regional office. The regional manager can do logistics and stock and all of that. And then corporate can see the statistics of how many Snickers they have sold and all that kind of stuff. So there's a whole lot of interesting things that you can do with CouchDB. Bear with me for the next slide. It may sound or look ridiculous, but there's a really good use case for this as well. The big mesh of couches. And here think Internet of Things and less at the home, where we have a bunch of so-called smart devices, but more industry of things. Think of a couple of thousand Internet of Things sized sensors that maybe measure air pollution and heat and all that kind of stuff sprinkled across an oil refinery. So we can make predictions like this pump is running, has been running hot over the past 3 months. We may have, like, it's more likely to fail than any of the other pumps, so we need to fix that one. But in an oil refinery, you usually don't have any Wi-Fi, so you have a mesh network, and maybe there's an uplink in the main office, main manager's office, or maybe someone comes by every week with a thumb drive, and that's your connection up to the internet. But eventually, all of this data can be collected and put into the cloud for big data analysis. So this is all a bunch of fun stuff that you can do with the couch. All right, now this talk is about what this arrow is about. How does the synchronization actually work? How do we write to all of these, and how in the end does it all work out? So why, basically, why is this magic actually possible? This all started, so that's an old saying, friends don't let friends do X, because X is hard or terrible. So my version of this is friends don't let friends build their own crypto sync or database. Mostly this is friends don't let friends run off a cliff. Because each of these are incredibly hard, and if you start thinking about, oh, this shouldn't be too hard, I'll get going, and then the more you keep going, the more you learn this is really hard, and next thing you know, 10 years are over, and you've built a synchronizing database. So a friend of mine got me there, because I have a database that synchronizes, so next thing must be a crypto thing. But there's a problem with this train of thought, or with the line of thinking. If we pretend there's things are too hard for people to learn, then eventually all the experts retire and like nobody knows crypto anymore, or databases anymore, or synchronization anymore. And I think that's a bad idea. So let's make you synchronization experts. At the end of the talk, you know, at least on a high level, the ingredients to build a successful and reliable synchronization system. You learn about the trade-offs in different design decisions that we've made for our particular one, but it also gives you alternatives. So if you ever have to build one yourself and for whatever reason you can't use Couch, which is fine, you know which other options you have in building the synchronizing data system. All right, the number one thing we need to be have a synchronizing system that works in the way I roughly explained already is identity. We need to uniquely identify a data record. In databases 101, we learned that a nice thing you can use is natural keys. Say the last name is our primary key for the data records. If I see Ebblesworth, I know it's this data record because it's unique within the list here. This works fairly well. We can add a few more people, but maybe you can spot that there might be an issue coming up. Right? We get a John Doe and then a Jane Doe, and all next thing we know, Doe is no longer unique, and we don't know which record we mean. So easy. We just use the first name, last name combination to be the primary key, and we get another Jane Doe, and we can't use that as well. So that's not a good idea. All right. So there may be more personal identifying information, but then your key gets bigger and bigger, and that's not useful either. So what database people have come up with is what's called a surrogate key. If you've seen a MySQL table ever, you probably notice the ID column that's an auto increment, and every record just gets a sequentially updating ID. It's guaranteed to be unique within the table. So that's a very easy way. We can have three people called Doe. We can even have two Jane Does, and they all have their own unique identifier. None of this is news to you, I hope. So, but I explained that you can have multiple databases, multiple like nodes that having the same database and they can synchronize. So say we have this database here up to 7, and then we write a new record 8 on the one with Eric Erickson over here, and a new one with Ethel Easterbra over here. So it's two very different records, but both get the same ID. So auto increments don't really work for us. We can't do this. The solution, and I'm skipping a bunch of options here, that is generally accepted now is using UUIDs, globally unique IDs with a key space big enough for everything that we've ever want to put an ID on. They're 32-bit strings usually. And you can already see one of the downsides. It looks a little bit broken, but it's deliberate. They use 32 bits instead of just one byte or a couple bytes for an integer. That's one of the downsides. The upsides is, say, we identify who this John Doe, this John Doe is. Actually, no, this comes later. Never mind, sorry. But now the two records down here created independently get a unique ID, and there's no conflict or no collision here, which is not the downside, of course. More storage space, there's no direct correlation between the ID and the name or the record. Like, this, like, doesn't, you don't know, there's no thing here. Other unique keys that people, that where you know there's a correlation is phone numbers, but people are ridiculously bad at remembering them. If you've been around the internet for a while, in the early days of instant messaging, ICQ numbers were really short and people could remember them. Okay, I saw one smile over there, so that's good. All right, so we use UUIDs for identifying things. Oh yeah, one more thing. If we ever identify John Doe, then we can just change the name here, and the association with the primary key doesn't change, which is a very useful property as well. So this is our recipe book. So far we have all the things that we need to do have a robust synchronizing system. Identity. Any questions so far? Is that a question? Good.
I was looking for like cases when you use CouchDB like with Raspberry Pi or something like that.
Yeah.
And what are the advantages? I mean, for example, what are the advantages for CouchDB in front of like MongoDB?
Okay, that's a more general question. Can we do this after the talk? Like, I was specifically about identity.
Okay, got it.
Sure, no worries.
I have a question here.
Sure.
How about hash collisions, the remote possibility that two records have the same hash?
Okay, so hash collisions for the UIDs, the key space for the IDs is big enough that it's guaranteed to be not, so unlikely it's not going to happen. So it's big enough for all the stars in the universe and all the grains of sand and all the beaches in the world. Collisions don't happen. Yeah.
Okay.
And there's like UUID is an industry standard.
But in the case that the impossible happens, is there some way to fix it up, like change?
So in Couch, you can specify your own ID if you want, and nobody, like, you can specify the same ID in two nodes and mean different records with them. There's ways to deal with this. I'll show that in a second.
Okay, thanks.
All right. The next thing we need is we need to know what is new. So I've already mentioned the changes feed briefly. We need to know what happened in the database. Think the scenario, we have a database and we want to synchronize it to another database. So what we need to do, give me all the documents and move them over to the other database. And it's fairly simple. We just like go through this list here and move all the documents over there. And then say we add one over here and then we synchronize again. So what do? Just go through the list again, because maybe I've added one here. You notice this is sorted alphabetically. So maybe I'm adding one here. I'm going to start at the start again, move this over, move this over, move this over. But then I see on the target, oh, I've got this already. I don't even have to do this. And then I get to this one and move it over. But I don't know if that was the only one that I've written. So I have to do all the other ones as well. It's very wasteful, right? We don't want to do this. We're introducing a new index. This is also managed for you by CouchDB in the main database file. We call this the by-sequence index, and it includes a list of all the documents in the order they were written. So in this case, we see the document CA7 was written first, then DFF, then A0D, and then BE2. We couldn't see this from here. So this is indexed, so going into here is really efficient, even with millions of entries. And now we can do fun things like this. When we want to synchronize from database A to database B, we're starting with the update sequence 1, or 0, find 1, move C over, number 2, move DFF over, move AOD or A0D over, sort it in there, and then BE2 eventually. So we get the same database over there by following the order here. And also, we're storing for this from A to B connection or the synchronization that we have synchronized everything up to update sequence number 4. We call this the high watermark, how far we've got. So now we're writing a new record on database A and want to synchronize it to database B. It also gets an entry in the bisequence index, of course. And then when we replicate again, we have a checkpoint that says we have already replicated up until 4. And then we can ask CouchDB, or the bisequence index, give me all the records that have been added since high watermark 4. So we will only get the 5 and move that one over. And we store high watermark 5. So calculating the delta between two databases that are replicating and are continuously replicated is very efficient here. The next thing that we need to worry about is updates. What happens when we update a record? How do we track this? So say we identified John Doe. It's actually John Easterhayes. I made the change here. I put a star here to signify that this is a new version now. Simple. We just record this in our update sequence log or in the index. We get an index number 6 with the star version of E32. And then when we replicate with high watermark 5, we know we can move this entry over here. And everything is done. Works pretty well, right? Slightly different scenario. So we still we made a typo. His name is not John Easterhayes, but Easterhose. It's an O for an A here. So we edited it twice. So we have 2 stars over here. And by our system so far, we get 2 entries in the bisequence log 6 and 7. And now when we do synchronization from high watermark 5, we find number 6. Move that one over, and then number 7, move that one over. So first Easterhayes gets synchronized over, and then we override it again right away with Easterhose. And wouldn't it be a lot more efficient if we just moved this one over because we know this is going to be it eventually? Yes, of course it is. So CouchDB not only keeps the update sequence in here, but it also keeps the list of documents unique, and it always keeps the latest version in here. So you see the update sequence can have gaps. Update sequence 5 is when we created this record, and 6, when we updated it the first time, no longer occur in the update sequence. So when we do synchronize from high watermark 5, it finds 7 and syncs the one that we need only. So that's also, again, very efficient. Next, deletes. How do we handle deletes? Say we are deleting this record. This also gets an entry in our update log, and the entry is that thing is now, like that ID is now deleted. It's important for us to know. So when we now replicate or synchronize, or when I say replicate, that's the internal name for us, but synchronization is the same thing. And when we synchronize with high watermark 7, we find 8, we find it's a deletion, and then we replicate over, synchronize over the deletion, and then we have the ID over there tracked as well. What you will notice is that the record doesn't go away, but it's now marked as delete. So if you write something into CouchDB, the information that document ID has ever existed will stay around. You can resurrect it later. You can purge it in exceptional cases, in cases your social security number or credit card number or something. But in general, CouchDB will continue to know that this document has existed and is now deleted. You can also put some information in there, say this was deleted because of this reason, because if you need this for like policy reasons. But the reason we keep this is because you can have many more databases going on as well, and say we have a database C over there that needs to replicate that also has this data set, but now replicates from B to C. C also needs to know that it needs to delete document B, and therefore we need to keep the information that this document has ever existed. All right, we have identity using new IDs. We know what happened since. We can handle updates of our documents. We can efficiently calculate the delta between two databases. We are not sending updates twice if we already know that a change, like the final state of a document, we don't move over the intermediate states. And we handle deletes just like updates. The coalescing of updates is different from, say, version control. In Git, you want all the commits between two states because you want to maybe work with those. In CouchDB, keeping the intermediate states for synchronization would complicate this significantly, so we're not doing this. Okay, up to this point, any questions?
So you keep deletes in your database, so how do you freeze in this space? I mean, at some point, you you might want to remove all the deleted information.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes, eventually, maybe, but so you can. That's the process for this, but yeah, it's outside of the scope of how the sync works. But you can if you want. But usually, you don't.
Can it happen that the data was deleted too early, and then the sync is failing somehow? I mean, what's the process to delete to really remove deleted data? Because if that happens before the sync, then you can have the old data being synced back to the previous nodes.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So how does it work in Couch?
There's a mechanism called purge that you need to run on all the nodes that participate in replication. And only when you get purged from all of them, they never show up anywhere anymore. But this is outside of the scope of this. Other questions about this? All right, cool. Next thing, when versions. So when I said we're updating this record, I put a star and a double star for the second update in there. CouchDB doesn't actually use stars in there. That's not as nice as it would be. So the next ingredient we need for reliable sync is specifying that we have different versions of the same document or record. And again, the first idea here is the auto increment, which could be very simple on database A and database B. Synchronizing from A to B, we have the same record here, but then the problem with this is basically the same as the previous one. We make two edits, one on A, we change Antonia to Bubblesworth on database A and to Wibblesworth on database B, and now it's the same document, but they're different versions, and they have the same version number. So it's the same problem as before. We can't use those. But what is nice about integers or auto-increment integers? They're strictly ordered, or in math terms, they're monotonically increasing. What else is monotonically increasing that we could use for versions? A timestamp. Good. Well, we didn't plan this. So the next 5 minutes is going to be the comedy hour of this talk. There are two blog posts with lists of falsehoods programmers believe about time and a SQL. There's about 120 of those. I have the top 20 here. Some of these are funny. Some of these are irrelevant for our problem space. All of these statements are not correct. They are false. None of them are true. The system clock will always be set to the correct local time. The system clock will always be set to the time that is not wildly different from the correct local time. If the system clock is incorrect, it will at least always be off by a consistent number of seconds. The server clock and the client clock will always be set to the same time. The server clock and the client clock will always be set to around the same time. Okay, but the time on the server clock and the time on the client clock would never be different by a matter of decades. If the server clock and the client clock are not in sync, they will at least always be out of sync by a consistent number of seconds. The server clock and the client clock will use the same time zone. This is a favorite. The system clock will never be set to a time zone, to a time that is in the distant past or far future. 1 minute on the system clock has exactly the same duration as 1 minute on any other clock. Like, all of these are false. Okay, but the duration of 1 minute on the system clock will be pretty close to the duration of 1 minute on most other clocks. Also not correct. Fine, but the duration of 1 minute on the system clock would never be more than an hour. Also not correct. A timestamp of sufficient precision can be safely considered unique. This is relevant for our interests. Whether we make the change at different times, we may be able to differentiate the two versions here. And you get into situations, if two users at the same time click on that button, and that maybe is unlikely if you have microsecond resolution for timestamp, but as soon as you have computers doing the work, hitting these microsecond precisions gets really probable. All right, next. It is possible to establish a total ordering of timestamps that is useful outside your system. Timestamps always advance monotonically. We needed that earlier, so that doesn't happen either. My software is only used internally and locally, so I don't have to worry about time zones. My software stack will handle time zones without me needing to do anything special. And now the favorite two and the last ones. All measurement of a time of time on a given clock will occur with the same frame of reference. In other words, time passes at the same speed on top of a mountain and the bottom of the valley. None of these are true. So we don't use timestamps. Two more anecdotes with this. Google has built and wrote a paper about a globally consistent SQL database called Spanner. I think it was 2012. Most of the paper is how Google worked around all these issues, which is a phenomenal engineering feat, which you can only do if you have Google resource of engineering, which nobody has. So Spanner is not an option for us. Second, Google's two-factor authentication frequently fails because either the client or the servers are on different times, so the two-factor authentication tokens are no longer valid or considered valid by either one of these. So they can't even get that right internally. Could I ask one of you to close the door? There's some noise coming in. It's slightly irritating. Thanks. All right, so we can't use timestamps, really. Give me a second. There we are. Before we learn about how to improve on timestamps, we need to familiarize ourselves with one more concept. And it's a concept from distributed systems. Anyone did some distributed systems here? A bunch of you? Good. So I hope you'll be with me here. So this is a slide from earlier. We don't want different versions of the same data have the same version. But actually, in regular programming, we are trained that conflict, this is what's called a conflict, obviously. So we're trained that conflicts are bad and that are to avoid it at all cost. Until you discover distributed systems. In a distributed system, and a distributed system is, I have at least two computers and a network connection, that is a distributed system. So everything we do these days is a distributed system. Conflicts are just a natural state of data. They're a thing that occur, like rain or sunshine. They're not to be discussed away, right? And it turns out that we know how to deal with conflicts as programmers as well. You've all seen these, right? Right, okay. So these are markers that are put in by CVS, SVN, or Git when it detects conflict, and it forces you to fix the conflict because, as far as we hope, this doesn't compile in any programming language that you might be using. It might look fine in HTML, I don't know, but I think they even covered that. So you hopefully never commit this back to your source tree. So we know how to deal with conflicts. The difference, though, is difference between an online database and a source code versioning control system, you can't mark a record as a gone or block it from access just because it has a conflict. So again, as soon as you have two computers connected by network, you have a distributed systems. Most other databases pretend that that's not a thing, especially the relational databases. When you do something like replication, primary, secondary replication, one of the things you're always looking at is the replication lag. Everybody gets nervous if the replication lag gets bigger than so-and-so, because then the consistency guarantees you get from a single node database, but you're actually using two nodes, the consistency guarantees that the application expects there are no longer given. So this is pretending physics don't exist, which I find really troubling from an engineering perspective. So conflicts are cool. We like conflicts now. I hope you're with me. All right, three people get the reference. I like that. So what's better than timestamps? Any guesses? You can't say anything. All right. Something called vector clocks, or called Lampert timestamp. They are sort of timestamps, but they are logical time. They are not based on actual clocks, but on a common base. And you can tell afterwards, if you're with a series of timestamps, which came after the other, but you don't know exactly when that happened. But that we don't need to know that. We only needed to know what comes after what other database. So these are very, very good for the thing that we need. Now, the reason why we can't use them in CouchDB, I'll explain in a second here, which is an interlude to explain one of the use cases in CouchDB. I explain this in way more detail in the other talk, but this is a typical three-node CouchDB 2 cluster. We have a database 1. Databases have multiple shards. We only look at one shard. it's backup and it's other backup. So we store everything three times in CouchDB here. And now we want to write to node B. And we have parameter N here that we tell as the client, please use at least N many nodes to fulfill this request. So in this case, please write the document to all the nodes before returning the call. So what would happen now, if I would put the document ABC in here, it would be written into here, a new vector clock would be generated. It would be written into here, a new vector clock timestamp would be generated, and here as well. And all of these would be different timestamps because they don't coordinate and they don't look at the content of the data. So I would have a three-way conflict just by writing document here. There are ways around this. Either we generate the timestamp here on this node and then move it here and here, but that can lead to conflicts down the road. Or we resolve the conflicts by reading the next time and doing content hashing on the way out. Other databases do this as well. We decided against this for this and other reasons. So introducing and cleaning up conflicts that we don't actually need are a downside of vector clocks in the system that CouchDB wants to support. Instead, and I hinted at that in the opening, we're using content addressable versions. They are a hash over the contents of our document, and currently it's an MD5 hash, so don't use this for any security-relevant things. We will redesign this, of course, but this is currently what it is. The problem with content addressable hashes is that there's no ordering built in, right? So CouchDB does the simplest thing that you can do, store it in a list. So you have revision A, revision B, revision C, revision D, revision E in here, and that's what that looks like. It's not as elegant as vector clocks, where the ordering is in the timestamps. It would be really cool, but for the thing that we want here, the way if I make the same change to different nodes to come up with the same version and not create a conflict, this is the only way we can do it. Of course, you can have infinite number of updates on a document, so this would be an unbounded list. I guess that would be your next question if I wouldn't be explaining this now. So if I have a million updates here, is this list a million items long? No, it isn't. There's a limit in there. Currently, it's 1,000, so I can have 999 updates and then still converge on the document in a different database if I wanted to and not produce a conflict. And I can change this per database of how many revisions to keep. So if I know I'm only usually mostly converging by, say, 20 updates before it goes back, I can like reduce storage requirements. Or if I need more, I can put it up if I want to. All right, so with all the things that we have so far, let's look at how replication could look like. And previously, I showed you how to calculate the delta of the different documents and their updates and the deletes and how to get them over. And now we'll look at the same thing, but only for one document, what it actually means to go from one database to the other with the knowledge about versions that we've now gained. So we're writing a database on the left, document with the ID 1 and the revision or version. It's the same thing again, A. I'm going to omit the ref in the future. We're writing a new revision B, and you already notice we're not only storing revision B, but the fact that B comes after A. This is the ordering that we need to know what happened when. We're writing a new version C, which we know comes after B, comes after A, and now we replicate to the database on the right. And what happens is CouchDB takes the latest version of the document and moves it over to the database over there. So on that database, we know we have a document with the ID 1. It is revision C. Which comes after B, which comes after A, but the other database here never knows what B or A actually looked like. It only knows that they were there. So since we can write on both sides of the database, we're writing a new version D and a new version E, and then we replicate back. And what happens here is CouchDB gets this update in. It sees, oh, I already have a document with document ID 1. It has the revision history CBA. Is this the same here? So what CouchDB can see now, since CBA exists here as well, that this is a direct ancestor of this document. There's two edits that came in between. So it can just accept this as the latest version of this document on this side. In Git terms, this is called a fast forward. So we can just go to the new level. Now, the fun part, I'm writing a new document version on the left side, revision F, and on the other side, revision H. And then I replicate. Now what happens? We do get a conflict. CouchDB keeps both revisions in here, keeps them in another list within the list. It picks one of the versions to be the winning revision. If this conflict occurs on multiple nodes, it always picks the same winning revision independently of any of the other nodes. So we always have a consistent view of the data in the database, but we also get a marker in the JSON of the document that tells us that this document is now in conflict. So it's like the markers in version control, but it's in the live data, so you can deal with it interactively. And then you can resolve the conflict in any way you want. You can choose that F is the right thing by deleting H. You can choose that H is the right thing by deleting F. You can create a new database G, revision G, F, G, H, K maybe, that has sum of F and sum of H, and go in. So if you've done computer science, you've seen this notation. So this is obviously a list. This is a list of lists, and there's another way to represent this, of course. This is in reality a tree. So CouchDB can have a lot of conflicts, and we can handle these efficiently in a tree. And two, by recursing the tree of conflicts, you will always know that you can solve them all deterministically. And if you've done this, if you have 15 conflicts in there in this tree, and you solve them one by one, and then replicate this solution to any of the other nodes that have the same set of conflicts, they will all resolve with the same strategy, basically. So we know you can follow them up every time. All right, so we have identity. We know what happened since. We can build the delta of documents. We can handle updates and deletes. We're coalescing updates so we don't send stuff over that we don't need. We're embracing conflicts because we understand that we live in a distributed systems world. And we're using a list of content addressable versions. I'm certainly Sean Connery. Versions to signify which version we're having. If you're building your own synchronization protocol and you don't have the same requirements as Couch has, you can choose to use vector clocks or Lamport timestamps instead of the content addressable versions if you want to. So now you already know that you have a bit of leeway there. There's a bit of bonus material. There's other ways to synchronize data that are completely different from anything that I just showed you. The first is operational transforms. It's what powers Etherpad and Google Docs are used to power Google Wave. It is really good for usually connected or casually connecting collaborative text editing. You usually know that after a minute of offline, Etherpad logs you out and you have to reload the page to get in again. There's two reasons for this. A, if you converge very far with two sets of Etherpad, with operational transforms, there's a lot of computation that needs to happen to get this together again, so it takes a lot of CPU time to get this. And second, imagine you've been editing, like two people have been editing offline for a week, and then they synchronize again. It's going to be a really interesting user experience seeing all this data flow in again, so it's not really usable at that point. So there's a hard cutoff of how long you can be offline. So for that reason, it's not really useful for Couch, where you can take things fully offline if you wanted to. So that's not very good. Mentioned this. The next thing is CRDTs, or conflict-free replicated data types. These are special data types designed for distributed systems that have no conflicts. Oh my God, why don't we use those? That would be great. The thing is, they're only specific data types and they keep developing new ones, which is nice. So there's lists, trees, hashes, counters, that type of stuff. But they all behave differently than we are expected from other, what we're expecting from regular. Regular data structures in our programming language. So not all problems can be mapped to a CRDT, sadly. If you have a use case where a CRDT fits, they are really, really good. You can definitely use those. And you can model, like if you represent them in JSON, you can use Couch again if you want. And the latest development in this is a paper from August this year. I haven't had time to read through this yet, but it promises to be a bit of a holy grail or move this as far further as anyone has ever had. It's a paper called Conflict-Free Replicated JSON Data Type, so CRJDT, I guess. It has no collisions. It is very new. I haven't read the paper yet, so I don't know how good it is. My expectation is that there are still some semantical changes between just how I expect JSON to work, or the lists in JSON to work, and how it works here, based on the properties that CRDTs have. But again, this is the link. This is like brand new. This is like cutting edge research. This is the brandest newest thing that anyone has ever done in this. I'm really looking forward to get my reading on this one. If this turns out to be more generally useful than CRDTs, we're definitely going to build it into CouchDB. So next year I'll be talking about how we built this into Couch. So now you know how to build a robust synchronization system. I skipped a few things, like when you delete, I mentioned resolving a conflict, you can delete one, right? We also keep track of deleted conflicts because they need to replicate as well in case I need to resolve other conflicts on other nodes later down, and the same limiting applies as with the version hashes. So there's a little bit more complication in here to make it generically useful, but now you know all the things that you need for building a robust sync engine. You know a bunch of the trade-offs that we made for design decisions that we've made that you can make differently if your system has different needs. And you've seen a bunch of alternatives of the whole system. So if this is too heavy weight for you and maybe a CRDT works for you, then you can use that. With that, I say thank you for your time. I hope you learned something. If you want to chat about things, please find me. I'm around all day. Thank you very much.
We do have time for questions.
No questions. One question.
Just wondering, if you synchronize every database with every database, it must be a huge one.
With the amount of data. Yeah.
If you have a million databases synchronize everything with each other, it must be huge.
That is correct. You mean the mesh networking scenario? You don't have to build this globally, of course, right? You don't have to have every CouchDB database doesn't have to replicate with everyone, only the ones that you need, right? But say you have the mesh network situation you're having like maybe you're getting measurements for like how warm is the air like around. Maybe specify.
Just for you talked about the Italian supermarket.
The what? Well,
the Italian supermarket. The corporate database does not necessarily want a copy of every record. From every store. Just a summarize of something.
You could do this as well, of course. Have at the regional level, have an aggregation going on into a separate database, and then only that gets synchronized to the corporate. So in this scenario that we've like the supermarket chain we have built, corporate wants everything. That's going to be big databases eventually, but that's why CouchDB is clustering, so you can throw as much hardware as you want against it if you need this case. Maybe for the current year you need all the information that you need, but like next year, like for tax purposes or whatever, but the next year this can be live in an archive. So one of the strategies we usually use with CouchDB with so-called time series database is that you, for the interval that you need the live data, have a database, and then once you're done with it, like when the new interval starts, start a new database, and then archive the other one either into a different system or lower performance cluster or something where you only need things for archival database. So the live data is only like as big as like maybe the current year, the current month, the current week. If you use CouchDB for logging, there's a scenario where we change databases every hour, and then after 24 hours we throw the databases away because we only need to keep them for a day. And we know that analytics have happened already out of them, so all the aggregate data has happened before we delete them again. So there's a bunch of these strategies as well.
I think the situation would be very complex with three or more databases. Like, you still have to keep the history in each case.
Right.
But because we only saw the simplified case, right? And let's say, for example, a bank, someone retires money in offices in Europe, mm-hmm. and and someone in the United States closes that same account, then you lose that information about who.
For banking, I wouldn't argue. I would just keep everything. Okay. But then I'm a bank. I can buy all the hardware.
And other conflicts are resolved manually, right?
Sorry?
Other conflicts are resolved manually, just like you would do.
Yeah, this is, so manually is up to the application because there's no generic way to resolve conflicts. There's a few things that we could make it easier for you. Like a three-way merge. By default, CouchDB doesn't look at the JSON, just at the version number because it's content addressable. We know different versions, but we don't look into it. But if you say change the one change is change of the last name, the other change is the phone number, that could be a save merge. And we could build in some strategies to say, okay, if we have different fields in there, then do the merge for us, or have some generic software service that sits on the side that does this for us in real time using the changes feed again. We haven't built this yet, but this is one of the first things that applications build. Have a little bit of code that explains the application specific merge, and cover all of these. Sometimes if you train different changes come in, it's both the phone number, a human has to look at this. So that's where it's actually manual. Nice.
Okay, thank you. Oh, wait.
Sure.
Thanks, Jan, for a great talk.
Thanks.
Could you share something about future plans for CouchDB roadmap, something?
Yeah, so,
something new.
So CouchDB 2 came out 2 months ago. It adds the clustering layer, a query language, a lot of performance improvements over one. We've spent 3.5 years building this, and we don't want to have major versions take this long anymore. So we're now taking small things and making the next major version. The next support is going to be HTTP2. I was hoping to ship this within 6 to 12 months. We're also in parallel working on pluggable storage engines, so you can have different storage engines with different characteristics in there. That's probably going to be CouchDB 4 in 18 to 24 months. I have a student researcher working on, I mentioned there's a query language that we added to CouchDB that compiles into the MapReduce system, but it's not as flexible as the MapReduce system yet, so making this more useful and maybe even make it as flexible as SQL, and maybe even have a SQL to query language to MapReduce compiler in Couch so you can make SQL queries against the cluster. It wouldn't be all of SQL, of course, but just for programmer familiarity, this is something I want to push forward. So the protocol was designed for server to server, but we've now been using this a lot in a mobile scenario. There's implementations of the sync algorithm in JavaScript for in-browser use and in native iOS and Java Android. And we have made some optimizations to the protocol, but it was never designed to be used in a mobile use case where you have very long latency, very low bandwidth. It's very different than server to server, that's sometimes severed, but sometimes not. So we want to redesign the whole protocol make a new version of the protocol that is optimized for mobile use. And at the same time, use all the new HTTP2 semantics for the connection pooling and everything. So that's going to be the next 3 years is going to be that bubble of things, I guess. Yeah.
And encryption?
Encryption is a good question. It depends on what you need. So if you need encryption at rest, use encryption file system. There's no need that we build that again. If you do
HTTPS,
HTTPS is supported, TLS is supported, and you can also, what we usually do, I have an AJ proxy in front of Couch that does the TLS termination, and then internally I do HTTP, but you can use HTTPS in CouchDB as well. And then data encryption, of course, if you want to address, is only so useful, but again, use a file system, but then end-to-end encryption, it's more interesting to look at the JavaScript and the phone implementations. And for the JavaScript version, there's a crypto plugin that does public key encryption from a password-derived key. So with the user password, it is locally encrypted, and only with that password you ever get the data back in CouchDB. The JavaScript version of CouchDB called PouchDB, and the CouchDB server never see the actual data in there. And there's a few things in there never mind. This would be end-to-end encryption that would work. But I think we're out of time now.
Okay, yes. Thank you very much.
Thanks again.